Okay. So there have been a couple of questions that have come up that I want to try to answer. We may have more to merge today. That's good. One of which is actually pretty mundane. And the other two of which to answer thoroughly would require us to reconstitute the entire field of computer science, but we'll try not to do that. People have been trying to sort out, why is there a protected payload and also an endpoint ID, and when should I use which one? The specification gives a little bit of a hint, but in terms of what it says in a normative way, right, it doesn't really help you out on it. It's always the case that the specification tells you what the mechanism is, and it's left for you to sort out how you want to use it. In this case, probably the easiest way to shed a little less darkness on this question, I'm not sure I'll shed light, is to explain how endpoint IDs came into existence. That'll at least illustrate the problem that they were an attempt to solve. Whether we in fact solved the problem remains to be seen. Kiko's system and in the Eros system, there was no endpoint notion. And an analogous set of relationships was a process, and you had a capability. This is the capability that's the Kiko's thing most comparable to an entry capability. And in Kiko's, there were two types. There was one that was called a start capability. This is the one you use when you're calling a process. And then the one that went in the other direction is called a resume capability. And the distinction between the two has to do with what contracts you have about what process states the guy on the other side is in. So if resume capability exists, you know it follows from the specification that the process the resume capability points to is in a closed wait, what they call a waiting state. It's in a closed receive specifically for this resume capability. If you hold a start capability, you have no contract about what state the other guy is in. In the same way that if you hold an entry capability in Kyoto's, you don't know if the guy on the other end is receiving right now or not. And the other property about resume capabilities is once you invoke one successfully, it goes poof, so you don't get to invoke it twice. And in Kyoto's, we have a slightly different mechanism for that. It's a counter in the endpoint. We reuse the protected payload field in a sleazy way. But the rationale is the same. You want to make sure that every call has at most one reply. And in Kyoto's, there is a set of relationships that are encoded in a different way. And the end result of that is we don't need two entry capability types. In Kiko's, there's a field in the start capability. It corresponds directly to what we call the protected payload. They call it the data byte, or in Eros it was called the key info field, the only difference being that the Eros one had more bits. And in Kikos that was 8 bits, and in Eros it was 16 bits. You may notice it continues to grow. And it was exactly the protected payload. So when I invoke a start capability, if the call makes progress, the recipient is going to get the key info field in exactly the way that our recipient gets the protected payload field. No endpoint anywhere, right? And that system worked in the field for 25 years, so obviously the endpoint must not be all that essential. Suppose I'm implementing something like a space bank, some kind of a server that implements multiple objects, that in each object, in a certain sense, has a separate identity from the other object. In particular, one of the characteristics that's very easy to point to and say, if you have this characteristic, you obviously must have distinct objects, is if you can destroy one of them without destroying the others. So you might think, what I would do in the Kiko's design is I would have two start capabilities if I needed two objects. And I would use, I'm going to use R notation rather than theirs. I would use two distinct protected payloads to tell me what the respective object numbers are. And it turns out that there are different permissions you can have on banks, so I'd use some of the bits for permissions, and I'd use some of the other bits for object number. Because bits is bits, right? I mean, how you interpret them is your problem. Okay, now I want to destroy The bank, whose identity I have encoded by the protected payload value 1. How do I do it? And I want to destroy that one without destroying the other banks. And they all point to the same server. How do I do it? What mechanism can I use? The first thing I can try, I have a data structure. I can set a bit that says, oh, this bank is destroyed. And then every time I get a request for that bank, I can say, I don't know what to do about that. Now, this would be a really stupid thing to do for two reasons. First, that field isn't very big, and I'm going to run out. The second is, I'm now paying the cost of doing work to basically tell you to get lost. This is not a sufficient solution, and it subjects me to denial of resource and denial of service attacks. So this is sort of not the preferred implementation. What else could it be? Is there something that if I were to destroy it, would cause those capabilities to cease to be valid? Because I have the capability to go page. That's my page. There is a destroy operation on the page. What happens to the capability when that destroy operation is performed? Well, actually, it turns out it doesn't point to null, it becomes null, but it turns out that if we're trying to understand the system as an object system, it points to null is actually a better intuition. Yeah, it becomes null, right? So if I destroy the thing that a capability points to, the capability becomes null. The dangling pointers are bad for your null. Also, fattening. They cause zits in laboratory rats, but other than that, they're fine. So what could I destroy that would cause those start capabilities to become invalid in the Kiko system? If it's only one candidate, come on, take a wild guess. What could I destroy? Here's a clue. If somebody is pointing at a picture and there's only one thing in the picture, and they say, what could I take out? Pretty good bet it's the one thing. So what could I destroy? The process. What would happen if I destroyed the process to all the start capabilities? They all get killed, right? And the problem here is I wanted a way to kill one of them without killing all the others. Now, this pattern sometimes works very well. The circumstance in which it works very well is if what you're implementing has the property that one process equates to one object. How can I do that? I could, but there's still nothing I can destroy that says invalidate this protected payload but not that protected payload. So here's the problem. What you want, right, your intuition I think you're reaching for is to say, well, what I'd like is an operation that would say invalidate all of the capabilities to me that have protected payload ID 1. Unfortunately, this involves a total disk search. I can't do that. That's why we have that allocation count, is so that we don't have to do the total disk search every time we destroy an object. Not the counter and cheat. Okay, so if I'm one process, one object, I'm good, but if I'm one process, many objects, we got a missing link in the story. And the solution in Kikos is that they have an object called a node. Our system nodes were replaced in one context by GPTs and in the other context by endpoints. And a node, if it's properly configured, acts as a forwarding object. Okay, so the rule is, if I configure the node in a certain way, and there's a bit pattern inside the node, and I set the bits in a certain way, and then I invoke the node capability, whatever message I send to that node will be transparently forwarded to the start capability that is stored in that node. Now what's happened is, I have an indirection in the pointer. That's all that this accomplished, except it's a fairly expensive indirection, because anything you do in operating systems is expensive. And then there's another mode bit you can set in a node that says, by the way, here's a piece of information inside the node, perhaps it's a unique ID, and when the message goes through, pick that up too and transport it. If this starts to sound suspiciously like an endpoint ID, that's not an accident. Now, the client, the caller, hold this opaque node capability. If I want to cause that opaque node capability to become invalid, is there an object that I can destroy without destroying the space bank? No. Okay. So the existence of this intermediary gives me the option to destroy communication channels selectively. And in the Kikos model, I either use it or don't use it according to whether I need that capability or I need that operation. There's a problem with this design. The problem is that the start capability is on the wrong end of the equation. Because, for example, there are banks where you and I both want to hold capabilities to the same bank, But my capability can be used to allocate, and your capability cannot, for differing permissions on the same object. And I'm going to use that term loosely for a little while longer yet. And the place where you'd sort of like to encode those permissions is in the protected payload of the start capability. But you can't, because it's on the wrong end of the indirection. The next thing you might say is, oh, well, okay, what I'll do is I'll put the object ID in the start capability, okay, and I'll put the permissions in those bits that are stored inside the node. You're still not quite where you want to be, because here's what happens now. For each distinct possible set of permissions, you're not going to be forced to allocate another node. The reason is that in their design, the node capability does not have any protected payload bits. So what you'd sort of like is one set of bits for identity and another set of bits for permissions in this pattern. And unfortunately, in order to make that work, those bits have to be in the right places, and in the Kiko's design, they weren't. There's nothing structurally in the Kiko's design that would prevent me from inventing a new capability type to the node that would have protected payload, but there isn't room in the way the capability representation works in that system. Because of this experience, that this pattern, which turns out to be very common, is a pain in the ass to implement, we rearranged the system. First off, we renamed this use of the node, because a node is quite a large object and you only end up using one slot of it. So we put in endpoints to replace that. And we moved the protected payload to the outside. And then we made those bits that you would hide in the node using these sleazy mechanisms, we made them explicitly part of the endpoint design. That's why there are endpoint ID bits separate from protected payload. It gives you the place to stand to differentiate the object's identity from the permission that the caller holds on that object. One might imagine other uses for this set of bits. That's the one we had in mind when this went into the architecture. But for those of you who are kind of wondering when to use which, does that help a little bit on rationale? A little bit? No? Who's hopelessly confused? And I'm always hopelessly confused on general principles, so. Okay. If you're trying to figure out pragmatically which one to use, good test is, if I want to be able to sever one thing, if destroy one thing, one object, that my process implements, and not the other. That kind of identity, which object is which, that's probably something I want to put in the endpoint. I want to do permissions for two different holders on the same object. Probably want to put that in the protected payload. Not the only way, but it's sort of the way the architecture was intended to support. So, gather, somebody asked, why do I need two different streams at all? Let, you know, people call read and people call write, and I can do it all on one stream capability. You could. And there is a feasible design of a pipe object in which you control the flow by saying the sender only calls write and the receiver only calls read, and there's only one stream. Of course, there's no guarantee that the sender and the receiver obey. And a pipe, in some applications, is intended to be a unidirectional data path. And in those applications, the responsibility to enforce the unidirectional flow of information, somebody has to implement that enforcement. And the party who implements it is the pipe object. So when I call a pipe object, it has to know if I'm supposed to be putting in data or taking out data. In order to know that, it has to get some kind of differentiation for me. And that could be done with a protected payload, and that would work. And if it were done with a protected payload, you would only need one stream. But here's the catch. I can close one side of a pipe without closing the other side of a pipe. I could figure out which side was being closed on the basis of the protected payload. In a capability system, there is really no operation that is directly analogous to close. We happen to have one on IOStream. That's a polite nod to use. Really analogous operation is destroy. What we sort of want is for it to be the case that after I close my side of the stream, there could be multiple copies of that capability. It's like I could dupe a file descriptor multiple times. But once that side of the pipe is closed, it doesn't matter which of those descriptors I hold. It's closed. And whichever of those descriptors I write on, according to this logic, whichever of those descriptors I write on, it should simply not operate. Because we've said we're done, say, writing. In the Unix model, close is a very funny operation. Close is an operation on a descriptor. It's not an operation on an object. It says, I'm letting go of my capability. The object itself doesn't go until there are no more capabilities to it, or in Unix speak, no more descriptors. And there are pros and cons to that design, and I'll come back to that in a second. In that case, you don't close your descriptor, you destroy your object. That's the model. Once the object is destroyed, if you do another invocation on that capability should behave exactly as if it's invalid. Because the object's destroyed. It's logical. And we want the object to be destroyed, you know, realistically, not just logically. And the simplest way to do that is to shoot the endpoint. Of course, if the read stream and the write stream operate on the same endpoint, that would be unfortunate. You should end up shooting them both. That's why the design calls, in this case, that's why the design calls for using separate endpoints for the two streams. One issue has to do with security flow, but that can be done in either encoding. The other has to do with isolation of destroy behavior, and that can only be done with separate streams. But this raises a bit of a nasty sleeping dragon that we should probably exhume, turn over, and agree that it stinks, and then put it back to bed. This term object is a slippery beast coated in slime. When we talk about this pipe object, what's the object? Well, there is a thing we could point to and say, that's the pipe. It's the thing that administers the buffer. And on the front end of this pipe, there's a thing we could point to and say, well, that's the input stream. And on the back end of the pipe, there's a thing we could point to and say, that's the output stream. It's the thing that takes stuff out of the buffer. Okay, so here's the first question of the day for which it would be appropriate to serve a large quantity of beer if I were permitted to do that in class. Not that I would mind, but Hopkins would frown on it. Of course, yeah, I'm leaving in a month anyway, so perhaps I shouldn't care. How many objects are there in this picture? The input stream object, the pipe object. Are they the same object, or are they two different objects? Okay, you got a 50-50 shot. Take a minute to think about it, okay? This is better than playing roulette and betting on black, okay? Not much, but you know. So we don't have a double zero in this game. Alright?
They're different objects.
They're different objects.
What? So the reference is the input stream.
What does it mean not the same? And these two pointers point to the same bits, right?
Yeah, but you want to have some people be able to hold an input to the reference.
I agree that you want that, but that doesn't substantiate the assertion that they're not the same. And they obviously point to the same state. In what sense are they not the same? You're right. I'm trying to draw out why your intuition is right. Well, they would be different file descriptors, but that's true in the same sense that if I store 1 in the variable A and I store 1 in the variable B, they're not the same one. What is it that makes these two objects different?
Operation.
I mean, so that you can't get a...
Get what?
I mean, you're the right.
You were safer where you started.
Okay.
As you started down, and the path that you're also groping after, right, is the argument that an object is defined by behavior, and that even though the underlying representation, that is the process state, of the input stream, and the underlying representation of the pipe as a whole, and the underlying representation, for that matter, of the output stream, even though all those underlying representations are identically the same bits, the three capabilities have different defined operations and therefore different behavior. And they are therefore distinct objects. And that's a very clean statement of the programming language view of the world of what object means. Then there are people who confuse objects with types and inheritance, and that's another heresy that we'll deal with in a few minutes. But the first proposition is that object equals behavior, and that's the PL view of object. Everybody who talks about object systems agrees that objects are defined that way. There may be other properties they bolt on in their favorite language, but that property holds for all PL object systems. Now, the test of a proposition is to try to falsify it. So let's see if we can make this hopelessly confusing. I'm good at that. Here's the page. There are two capabilities to this page. One of them allows both read and write. The other one allows only reads. Are these the same object, or are they two different objects? About 30 seconds, somebody's going to want their first beer. What point of view is two different objects? Absolutely. It satisfies the definition. Does that make common sense in any universe you know how to think about? If you spend enough time being indoctrinated in the PLD of the world, the answer might be yes. That's equally true if you've been indoctrinated in socialism, and equally unlikely it would make sense. Those two different objects are one. The push on the PL intuition. Is there a relationship between those two interfaces that PL people know how to talk about in type systems? I know you didn't take Scott's PL course and get away without knowing this one. What's the relationship between those two capabilities? Right? Suppose we called that an object, right, and we had these two pointers. Really, a read-only capability has a subset of the operations of the read-write capability. What's the language term for this? There it is. Almost, but not quite. Inheritance also has this subset property, but inheritance has other properties that are undesirable.
Encapsulation.
No, we're not going to do the dictionary of all programming language terms either. Thank you for playing. It's okay. The thing about programming language is we wouldn't really run out of terms because each new paper, we also want to take a try at it. You're on the right track with subset.
Extension.
Actually, it's kind of the dual of what I'm looking for.
Subtype.
Subtype. There's a subtyping relationship. Okay. And let me make sure I get this in the right order. It's a little perverse about thinking about this as a subtype is that we would write, depending on our notation, we might use a subset notation or a less than notation, that a read-write capability is a subset, is a subtype of a read-only capability. A is a subtype of B. Every operation on B is valid on A. And second constraint, this is an open issue in a big, huge, and sucking chest wound in programming language design, is the qualifier and has the same meaning. And that's why this is not inheritance. Inheritance is a statement about interfaces, but it is not a statement about behavior necessarily. You can inherit the interface separate from inheriting the behavior. But in C++, the subclass can override an implementation of a procedure where the signature of that procedure is inherited. That's why subclasses are not subtypes. Now, what I'm trying to get at here, though, is that this subtyping notion is a really kind of a funny notion because it challenges the view that objectness equals behavior. If we want to take the object equals behavior view, we would have to conclude that these two things are, in fact, the same object to the extent that their behavior is identical. And then when we introduce this subtype notion, we're introducing the notion that there's actually a little more to this story about object, and this story that object equals behavior can't be the whole story. And this subtype notion is incredibly compelling. It appears in real or degenerate form in every language you've ever worked in. If I were to ask this question of an object, of an operating system designer, read-only capability and that read-write page capability, they point to the same object. What would the operating system designer say?
Bits.
Why? Same bits, okay? So the operating system designer's intuition is that object equals representation state. At this point, the programming languages people go to one side of the room, the object operating systems people go to the other side of the room, the programming languages people say, you don't have any principles, and the operating systems people say, your stuff doesn't work. And both sides are right. This is why becoming a faculty member often has the added advantage of making you permanently schizophrenic, especially if you work across two fields. So, for those of you who were trying to figure out what the object was, there isn't one answer. The answer is deeply confused. The answer is deeply confused because computer science is a deeply schizophrenic field on the question of what is an object. You will even find people in the PL community who will say that an object is the combination of representation state and behavior. And that's because they're trying to reason their way around this subtyping thing. And then the next group will say, oh, well, I could have two interfaces on the object that don't have a subtyping relationship. Neither one is a subset of the other, but I do an operation on one, and lo and behold, the behavior of the other changes. There is some sense in which they're the same thing. And groping after what sense that is a subject for philosophers. They have noticed that we talk about dining philosophers when we do the canonical operative systems textbook. I've always thought this problem was misnamed. Nobody's ever observed philosophers to do anything other than starve in the real world. So this is not quite representation state. We could imagine also implementing two capabilities, both of which name this page, neither of which has any behavior that in any way depends on the bits in this page. They just ignore it. They only use it so that they agree on identity. In that situation, and there might be no subsetting relationship between these interfaces, right? So in that situation, it's not even clear what the involvement, if any, of the representation state is. There isn't any representation state because it wasn't used. But to understand that, we have to actually get in and analyze the program. It's not something that we can decide from first principles. So if you're now hopelessly confused about what an object is, join the computing professionals all over the world. No agreement. And you'll find, particularly in the capability community, because look, capabilities have this very object-like behavior. This confusion has a way of surfacing and getting in your face because capability systems are trying to be object systems, but they can't quite get away from storage accountability. So there was a discussion on one of the capability lists I'm on over the last 48 hours. And the question is about something called the sever operation. Sever is the operation that says, take this page and guarantee that there are no more capabilities to it so that I can reuse it. Now, if that page is part of an address space, I go in sever. The address space, in some sense, is no longer a coherent object. There is a level of abstraction at which we would like to think of the address space as a coherent object, a composite object. And then there's a lower level of abstraction in which we have operations that will allow us to violate the compositionality of that address space object. That's true in any system in which storage management is done manually. Any system that has a low-level destroy operation has this disparity between storage and object. But these two levels of abstraction, and they are entangled, and the fact that they're entangled is not escapable. The language people like garbage collection. You don't get to destroy anything. That preserves some integrity properties of objects compositionally that we'd really like to preserve because it's really damned awkward if we can't have a guarantee about it. Fortunately, in operating systems, we actually have to account for storage, so we don't get that luxury. If you pay for a page and I stick it in an address space, you're still paying for it. And the fact that I hold that address space doesn't mean I have the right to hold you hostage for the storage. And that's what happens in a garbage collected system of that style. Another way to say this is figuring out how accountability works in the face of sharing. Really tricky. Nobody's got a good foundation for thinking about it, much for objects. All right, so what really happens in practice? I mean, let's, having made a total hash of this, let me try to disentangle this a little bit. So what really happens is this word object is hopelessly entangled. And we don't use it as a formal term. We use it with each other, and there's usually contextual agreement about what we are pointing to in our head when we think object in the context of a given conversation. But there isn't any actual real agreement, and you will find conversations where the definition moves in the middle of the conversation and it's confusing. At least now you know what the confusion comes from. Full confusion. Let me say some things that do not relate to the definition of an object. Object is not an object by virtue of having a class. An object is not an object by virtue of being of a particular type. Although, that's a funny statement, because what does it mean to be a type? Well, it means the object has a particular behavior. So in a certain sense, it's the type of the object that determines what kind of an object it is. Well, subtyping makes that cloud. But it's not about inheritance, right? That's a particular flavor of object that came out of the small talk world and later the C++ world. But that's not what defines an object. And if you go look at the literature and sort of read the people who wrote carefully, you'll discover that in the systems where there's a class hierarchy, they don't call those object systems. They call those object-oriented systems. I'm not really sure what the orientation of the object is, and that seems like a politically sensitive question, so perhaps I won't get into it. But usually what people mean when they talk about object-oriented languages is languages in which they have this notion of class. Then they will get into whether a class is an object, and then they will invent the metaclass. And then they will ask whether metaclass is an object. This conversation doesn't stop. It's a rush in the wrong direction. And you fix it by a hack, which, and so small talk stops at metaclass. And if you ask, what is the class of metaclass? The answer is metaclass. And that only works because it's dynamically typed. This leads to the question, if an object falls in the forest, what is its type if nobody's there to see it fall? The reason that higher order type systems work in practice is that your program doesn't tend to engage in the patterns that drive the type system exponentially upwards to account for what you did. Okay, so having said this about classes, whether it's in the context of Java or in the context of ML, I'm now slowly switching gears. What's the purpose of a constructor? Why do safe programming languages have constructors? All of them do. First off, what happens when you call a constructor? Get back. How many of you have never written a Java program? All called constructors, surely you got something back. Tell you what it was. If not, we have a course for you, and it's not this one. Yeah, you call a constructor. An object reference. Now, if we were to crack open the covers, that object reference is really just a pointer, right? And the compiler is enforcing a type on it, and the pointer points to some bits somewhere. What is it that makes this thing an object? And there was some purpose of having the constructor as a separate purpose from allocating the bytes of the object. And certainly that happens too. But if that was all we needed, we would have been able to go with malloc. Something more we needed that caused us to introduce a constructor. Except the initial state of an object. And aside from your convenience as a programmer, which is an important consideration, why do we want to do that? We have well-defined content. Why do we care if we're well-defined? Okay, but now we're going back to convenience. There's a correctness issue. Why do we need them well-defined? You want them. I mean, I personally respect that, but that's not a good reason to put it in the program.
Because you
define the cause.
Some behavior of your use of those bytes.
That's not why they're defined. That's why the part that depends on them operates in a sensible way. You have the causality. You have causality backwards there, using consequence and dependency.
Defined.
Let's okay. Pause this for 1 second. You're struggling, and that was actually the point. A subtle issue. But what does it mean to be a byte? Actually, let me start even at a place before that. Restricting ourselves to enumerable types. What's a type? Well, actually, it's not. Enumerable type is a set. It's a set of of elements, each of which is one of the literals of that enumerable type. So if I say AB, right? A and B are literals. And this enum, if I were to give it a name E, right, that's naming the set of literals consisting of A and B. And in exactly the same way, if I say byte B, that's a shorthand for a rather longer enum consisting of literals from 0 to 255. I mean, we're talking about bytes any time after roughly 1980. If I say integer, not to be confused with int 32, I'm not talking about an enumerable type. Now I need to introduce the notion of an inductive type. But all the types that I can express in C, that's not quite true. Most of the types that I can express in C or in Pascal are enumerable types. Here's an example of a type that is not enumerable. So assume that foo is a type. Now I'm declaring this pointer, foo star f. That's not an enumerable type. I can't point to the universe of all possible foos. Actually, strictly speaking, whether I could point to the universe of all possible foos depends on whether my language admits EQ. If it does not, then this is an enumerable type. Enumeration might be extraordinarily large. If I don't have EQ, I won't lose enumerability until I get to recursive types. What's the constructor? But here's the thing. If I have a structure that contains a field of type foo star, then it's not enough. Actually, in this case, it is enough to ensure that the pointer is null. Because in most of these languages, null is admitted as a special case. Any pointer type in that kind of a language is really a union type of null plus pointer, right? But what the constructor does is it guarantees not only that there are particular values for all the fields, but also that the values satisfy certain constraints. And the difference between a pointer to 4 bytes in sequence and a pointer to a 32-bit integer has to do with initialization. And in exactly the same way, the difference between a pointer to some larger number of bytes and a pointer to an instance of some type has to do with initialization. There are two properties that are true after the constructor runs. The first is that the bits have been initialized. And the second is that there no longer exist any reachable pointers in the system to the byte layer representation. Because if such a pointer existed, I could violate the range requirements of the values. Therefore, I could violate the type system. Why do I want the language to make such a guarantee? I mean, that's a case where what's happened is we've designed syntax into the language to make a certain class of error impossible. And something kind of interesting happened there, right? Because the language syntax simply wouldn't let you have an object, but you still had an outstanding pointer to bytes. This storage versus object duality that we get into trouble with composition on in an operating system is completely hidden in a safe language. That's another part of why you get this confusion about object. Why do you want that? Why do you want that particular kind of safety? Well, because it gives us type safety, but why do you want type safety? It comes at this cost that we lose the storage duality, and a consequence of that is we can't account for storage in the same programming language. It can't, in principle, be done. Why is that okay? Sorry. We can account for storage in the sense that we can measure it, but we can't account for storage in the sense that I can get back any that I've allocated. That's explicit free operation, which means that if I'm getting billed, I can't get unbilled. Why do we want that? What trade are we making that makes that worthwhile? All of you would rather write in C? What you're saying? After this semester, the answer might be no. But I mean, I'm sure some of you don't really want to write in Java. But everybody has favorites on this, right? But why is it that people like the idea of the safe language?
You don't have to worry about malware.
That's certainly one issue, right? More generally, there's a class of mistakes that are structurally not possible in a safe language, right? The argument is the cost of those mistakes is important enough, it's worth making them structurally impossible, even at the cost of constraining the programs that you can express. And is that a good trade? Is it possible to write correct programs in C? The answer, strictly speaking, is no, because C is an undefined term. But let's duck the issue of whether there is a semantics for C and whether programs in C in principle have any meaning. You know, informally, obviously, we write programs and they work most of the time. Is it possible to write programs in C that work? Is it possible to write programs in C longer than 10 lines that work?
Right.
Evidence is getting shaky, right? Well, now, why is that? Some of it is we'll make mistakes as programmers. I've actually seen mistakes in Java code, too. That may surprise you. Some of those mistakes are stupid errors, right? I mean, we all make them. But some of those mistakes are qualitative errors, right? They have to do with things like input validation. For overruns. And buffer overruns are interesting because they sit on the boundary between structural errors that can carry that can be caught in the type system, where it's about the number of bytes I got, and logic errors where I got the right number of bytes, but the bytes weren't meaningful in the sense that I needed to interpret them. The first one is the programmer's fault. The second one is generally the fault of the guy who gave you the input, or the fault of the guy who failed, the party who failed to write a reasonable specification that actually said what would constitute a well-defined sequence of bytes. So there's a set of terminology that we use about this kind of issue in Kyotos. We'll talk about messages being malformed. You said you were going to send me a message that required 32 bytes. I got 8. I don't know what that message means, and neither do you. Okay. Messages being well-formed. When well-formed, we're a little sleazy about this term. But at a minimum, it means that the message you sent is at least internally consistent, right? If the message required 32 bytes, I got 32 bytes. If the message had a variable length component, and the component was supposed to be of a certain type, and you said there were 6 of them, I got the right number of bytes if there might be 6 of them. There's no point trying to do range checking if I haven't got the right number of bytes. There's a level of abstraction at which the message is valid. Not only have I got the right number of bytes, but they're credible bytes such that each of the fields is within its legally expressed range. For example, if I have an enumeration with 9 elements, there's no fundamental unit of storage I can allocate below 16 bits on a modern machine. But there's an awful lot of 16-bit values that aren't legal answers. If I'm expecting an element of that enumeration, you send me something that's out of range, that message is not valid. I don't know what it means, and neither do you. And finally, there are messages that are meaningful or consistent in a higher level sense, right? I can have a message in which each field individually is a legal value, but the fields taken collectively express nonsense at the level of the application interpreting the message. Why do I care? Why do this very pedantic exercise in message validation? Thinking about message validation. The answer is, a lot of yous don't know what your messages mean. I don't mean you in the classroom. A lot of message senders do not know what their messages mean. They send messages that are malformed. Now, if I go off and process those messages, right, I have a type system. My code is written to be type-safe, if I wrote it correctly. I mean, it's either type-safe because I use the same language, or it's type-safe because I'm a really hot C programmer and I was really careful. But the flip side of being type-safe is you're assuming that you got in well type stuff. If you have a case statement in a language or an enumerated value, the compiler has assumed you've got a valid value. It is not testing for an out-of-range value. So what it means to be statically typable is you don't have to do runtime checks. Anytime you have a message system, you have not got something that is statically typable. And the reason you go through this validation exercise is you're trying to check that the message that you got, that you expected would be of a certain type, is of that type, right? That's the validable. And further, that the message makes sense in some application intuitive way that the language really isn't able to capture usually. If there's a way for a user of a program to screw up the input, they will find it. And if the program processes that input without checking it, even a correctly written program will misbehave. So this kind of validation is one of a long list of things, types of paranoia that smart programmers engage in because paranoia is cheaper than bug fixes. It's part of defensive programming. Somebody asked, why do I need 2 strings? And then added, the guy writing is not going to call read. I promise you, the guy writing is going to call read. And I promise you they'll do it after the code is in the field. And I promise you that will turn out to be a scenario you didn't test. Because testers assume people are well-behaved, too. It's too much work to be paranoid all the time. This approach fails the altitude test. If you have a specification, in the case of the pipe, we don't have a complete specification, but if you have a specification that says data is supposed to flow one way, data better not flow one way because the client of the pipe is being well-behaved. Data better flow one way because data flows one way. No matter how hard the client is trying to screw with you. I'm not actually, in this discussion, worried about Eastern European 13-year-olds who are a threat because they run code built by the Eastern European Mafia, who is well-paid. I'm actually just worried about programs that run reasonably. Then if we get into security issues, we'll have to consider the Eastern European Mafia. It's the programmers who work for them. And a couple of others. Do you know that there's actually a market rate for a penetrated PC? And it's surprisingly large. I mean, you can make millions of dollars a year selling penetrated PCs if you don't get caught. I used to say the rate is falling. I'm pleased because that means the incentive for programmers to hack machines is falling. I'm displeased because it means nobody thinks it's a challenge, and that tells you something about the folks in Redmond elsewhere. I was trying to accomplish 2 things here. One is to point out that any programmer who starts from the assumption, my user will be well-behaved, needs to find another profession, preferably far away from programming. McDonald's has a position for you. It's equally true if you're going to be a lawyer, or at least if you're going to be my lawyer. The other thing I was trying to draw out is that there's actually a general pattern here, and it goes beyond just doing good programming practice. Right? This ties into our notions about type systems and our notions about programming language design. It even ties back into some of our schizophrenia because different parts of the field look at things in different ways. And in each of these areas where there is incomplete agreement in the field, it's an area where one side says one thing and another side hears a different thing, right? And stuff slips through the cracks and programs go wrong. And if the programs are used someplace important, people get hurt. And I wanted to show it's not just an operating system problem, right? It touches roughly the entire field. If we dig into theory, we'll find similar disagreements in the theory world, although these people are a little clearer what they're saying there when they bother to write down the map. In languages, we're starting to have math. Actually, we're more than starting to have math. Operating systems, we still don't have any math. I think it'll be the last specialty to have any for a variety of reasons. So, if you were the unlucky soul who put this question on the table, and I've spent the last hour and a half beating the crap out of you, I apologize, it wasn't personal. I don't actually know who it was. It is actually a reasonable question to ask as long as you're still a student. Anybody get fired if you're a professional? If your boss doesn't fire you for this question, your boss should be fired. But you know, there's a big question hiding behind the whole swamp. And it's at least worth knowing that the swamp is there, because then you can close the door on it, put up the deodorizer, and say, I don't want to go to that swamp anymore. So, let's take a 5 or 10 minute break. And then I want to do two things. I want to talk about final project. I know the second phase is not due yet, but we only have 2 weeks, so we need to talk ahead. And I want to talk maybe about some of what's going on at application level, because we're done with the kernel. So let's take 10 minutes and come back.